Ganley, this is NHPR News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released more dire predictions recently: scenarios of melting polar ice caps, acidic dying oceans, heat waves, heavy floods, and other mega weather disasters. And the panel said everyone on the planet will be affected. Chris Field is co-chair of the IPCC report.
We're seeing lots and lots of indications of changes in species locations or in fisheries operations or in agriculture, forest die-offs. It's really pretty dramatic how many examples there are and how far along the climate change path we've moved.
Meanwhile, soon after this international report hit world headlines, leading climate scientists in New Hampshire released their own predictions for the Granite State. But in addition to their forecast for a warmer and wetter future, they also looked at how communities might adapt, from road construction to farming methods to better home cooling techniques. Today in The Exchange, preparing New Hampshire for climate change. And later in the hour, we'll look at huge changes in the flood insurance program. But first, let's hear from you on this. What adaptations do you see your city or town already making? What more could they do to better prepare for this possible new world? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. With me in studio, Cameron Wake, climatology professor at the UNH Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space. He co-authored UNH's new report on climate change in New Hampshire. And Cameron, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Morning, Laura.
Also with us, Michael Simpson, climate adaptation scientist and chair of environmental studies department at Antioch University, New England, which just announced a new center to study climate change preparedness. And Michael, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, Cameron, I want to start with you, and let's just get some of the highlights from this research that you did on climate change impacts on southern and northern New Hampshire. Two different reports, although very similar. What's already happened, Cameron? What are we already seeing?
Well, I'd like to start the conversation with three main points here, Laura. The first point is that climate changes. It always has and always will. But now there's an extensive body and growing body of evidence that shows that human beings are actually the primary driver of climate change. And in fact, 97% of climatologists around the world are convinced this is the case. The second point is that New Hampshire's climate has been getting warmer and wetter over the course of the past century, and the rate of change has actually increased over the course of the past four decades. So what we're seeing is rising temperatures, primarily in winter and primarily in minimum temperatures, so warmer nights. We're seeing a significant increase in the frequency of extreme precipitation events, and those are defined many different ways, and they're all increasing. We're seeing earlier ice out dates on our lakes, which is particularly a concern for me because I love to play pond hockey, and we're seeing rising sea levels. The other part of our report really shows that we can expect these trends to continue into the future. So we're headed for a New Hampshire that has more heat waves in summers, warmer winters, less snow on the ground, more extreme precipitation events and rising seas. And then the last point really is that I see climate change as the innovation opportunity for the 21st century. That's both in terms of how we figure out how to reduce our emissions of heat-trapping gases via energy efficiency and renewable energies, but also really how we develop our civic structures around figuring out how we adapt to the new climate normal. And so our hope from this report is that we've provided a whole suite of very localized information for regional and local planners across the state, and we hope this information is integrated into their decision-making process and planning about investments in the future of our communities, and hopefully making those communities more sustainable and more resilient.
Well, and that's exactly where you come in, isn't it, Michael Simpson? Antioch's been focusing on community response. What have these changes that have already happened, that Cameron outlines, meant for New Hampshire cities and towns? What have they had to put up with that maybe they didn't have to put up with, you know, 20, 30 years ago?
Well, there's two parts to that. One is responding to extreme events that are out of the scale of history and building their preparedness, emergency response infrastructure to do that. And we've seen a lot of movement forward. Perry Plummer, who's head of the Homeland Security for the state, basically has taken many steps to move that agenda forward. Also, a lot of people have responded to hardware. That is, when things need to be replaced, such as culverts, they are starting to enlarge culverts. But as Cameron said, the true adaptation of a community is basically institutionalizing adaptation strategies into what they already do through their master plans, their building codes, their subdivision regulations, and things like open space planning.
Give us some examples on the ground of what you're talking about. You know, you mentioned culverts, for example. Just give us a couple more sort of bricks and mortar examples.
For example, Cameron's estimates of the future increase in summer temperatures is going to create increase what we call heat islands in cities and communities. And many cities have started to look very seriously at changing their, removing asphalt or changing the types of streets they have, making them much more tree-covered, and also changing their building codes to deal with the new energy demands that are going to come with higher temperatures. So you don't see these things necessarily because they're just planting the trees. They haven't grown up yet. But, you know, when we talk about climate change, we're talking about something that's happening in the future. His projections are into the 21st century, but we don't know when things are going to actually happen. As a result, we need to do what's called adaptive management. We have to make changes, and then we measure things, we evaluate them, and then 10, 15 years, we're probably going to have to make some new changes. So that's the strategy of how you adapt at the local level.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're looking at some new numbers surrounding climate change's impact here in the Granite State, and looking at adaptation, what communities need to do to prepare for this emerging reality, what some are already doing. Let's hear from you. What do you see your city and town doing to prepare for this possible future? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Cameron, I want to get into some of your predictions. You've got a not-so-bad scenario and then a bad scenario. But before we do, Cameron, as you and Michael both know, this winter here in New England and much of the northern part of the country was pretty harsh, leading some to say, Cameron, what global warming? I'm freezing, polar vortex, endless snow. So how do you work what we saw this winter into these dire predictions from both you at UNH and from the IPCC?
I think this is a great question, Laura, and one that I get a lot. And so I think really important here is that in a world that's being warmed by greenhouse gases, it's not that we're never going to have cold, snowy winters in New Hampshire. It's just that the odds of a cold, snowy winter are going to go down. The one thing that we know about New Hampshire climate is the dazzling uncertainty of it, as Mark Twain said. And so there's considerable variability from year to year. But what we've seen in the recent past and what we expect to see in the future is we will have fewer and fewer of these cold, snowy winters. The other piece I would add to that is that we've had about a decade of not so harsh winters. So the winter that we had this year was much like I remember in Montreal when I grew up there. We're not used to these cold, snowy winters anymore. So it was such a big impact. So we're just going to see less of them in the future, but we will still have them occasionally. And it's really the difference between weather and climate. We look at long-term averages as opposed to specific weather. And so we had a cold, snowy winter, and they're going to continue, but we're not going to have as many of them.
Well, did this winter sort of take some of the juice out of your efforts, maybe made people a little less concerned about these predictions?
There's people who have an agenda for this country not to deal with the issue of climate change, and I think it gives them a good talking point. But there are certainly, if you go back and look at what climate scientists have saying, we expect there to actually be more variability in the climate system, not less, because of all this energy that's in the system, more heat energy. And as a result of that increased thermal energy, we get more evaporation, we have more moisture in the atmosphere. As long as it's cold in winter, we can still get more snow. So in some ways, warmer winters in the near term will result in more snow. And that's especially true for parts of New England that are downwind of the Great Lakes, where the lake ice is retreating. But so we're creating a new source of moisture.
Wow.
So that variability is really a big challenge for communities. And we expect it to be more variable in the future, not less.
Well, and that's a great point. And variability is tough, Michael, for communities to work around. I mean, if you know what's going to happen, you can plan for it. But if you're not really sure whether it's going to be super snowy one year or super wet one year, how do you even begin to plan and budget for that? I mean, New Hampshire towns are not stuffed with cash.
That's understandable, and uncertainty is one of the biggest challenges in moving the agenda forward at the local level. However, you know, the towns have been experiencing extreme events. We've had, since 1970, the number of extreme events, especially large storms and flooding, has hit the Northeast substantially, and it's quite different than the frequency that came before 1970. And so these people have experienced this, and what the storms have shown, and some of these storms are on the scale of the projections that Cameron's making about the future, it shows the vulnerability of the community. And so we basically use what people already know to basically foment action and response. And we had a project in the Sunapee watershed where we actually didn't mention greenhouse gas or climate change. All we were dealing with was vulnerability to runoff. And so our biggest proponents at the end of that project were road agents.
Because they're tired of repairing these roads that get just washed out year after year.
Exactly. So, you know, the preparedness is just making us more resilient, okay? And so we focus on the things that people are experiencing first, but there's a whole series of vulnerabilities that come from Cameron's projections that we would go to a community, and we actually train our students to do that now, to identify if this is what the science is saying. These are where your vulnerabilities are. Here are your options.
Take off some of those vulnerabilities, if you would, because, again, this is a lot for folks to wrap their heads around, Michael. So you mentioned roads. You mentioned culverts. What else? What are some sort of obvious targets?
More ice storms. Basically, the distribution system for electricity is threatened. Okay, so if you have a centralized electrical system, you'll have tree downs and you'll have isolated communities. And we've seen this with the ice storms where communities have been isolated for weeks. And so the move is to decentralize and actually back up or duplicate energy sources, and especially for vulnerable populations. And that's one of our focuses. It's just not where's the vulnerability, but who is the most vulnerable that we want to focus on.
All right. A lot more conversation in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Winter is hard on cars, especially in New Hampshire. If you're thinking about upgrading your car, truck, or motorhome this spring, why not donate your old one to NHPR? It's easy. We fill out the paperwork and arrange for the pickup and sale of your vehicle. Call 1-877-393-NHPR to get things started, or go online to nhpr.org. More on adapting to climate change coming up on The Exchange, then a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, How the Civil Rights Act Changed America. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and Granite State Credit Union, with 6 branches statewide, providing full financial services to businesses and residents, including mortgages, online banking, and more. GSCU.org. From the City of Claremont, information about Claremont's investments in sustainable growth at ClaremontNH.com. And Kern Hatton Homes for Children, helping children in need grow physically, intellectually, emotionally, and socially. Information at HelpForKids.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, how New Hampshire communities are planning to adapt for climate change, extreme weather events, more extreme temperatures. Join us with your questions and comments. What might this mean for your city and town? What adaptations are already happening in your community? What more needs to be done? Join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page if you like, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Our guests are Michael Simpson. He's climate adaptation scientist and chair of the Environmental Studies Department at Antioch University, New England. And Cameron Wake, climatology professor at the UNH Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space. And both of you, before we go to our listeners, Cameron, as I said earlier, you just came out with a new report looking at climate change in southern and northern New Hampshire. You talked about what we've already seen, rising temperatures and a growing number of extreme weather events. You got 2 predictions, though, Cameron, sort of the worst case scenario. We do nothing about greenhouse gases. We continue willy-nilly. And then you have a better scenario. It's not great, but it's not terrible. So give us the bad news first.
I'll frame this up by saying the future climate is literally in our hands. The decisions we make today and over the next decade about how we produce and use energy is going to determine what our future climate is. And that really drives these two different scenarios, high emission scenarios where we continue to use fossil fuel versus a low emission scenarios where we invest in energy efficiency and renewable technology and help the developing world do that. And so we use those two scenarios because it's really difficult to predict human behavior out 1 year, let alone decades or by the end of the century. So we use those two scenarios to frame the problem. So if we look at the higher emission scenarios, we see dramatic change across New Hampshire's climate in the coming century. Probably the most significant issue is a tripling of extreme precipitation events.
A tripling? Yeah. Wow. That's a lot of washed out picnics and birthday parties and weddings.
Unless, of course, we begin to prepare for that and make our communities more resilient to this flooding. We also see an increase of 4 to 5 to 6 times in the number of extreme hot days. Those are days above 90 degrees Fahrenheit. That happens more in southern New Hampshire than in northern New Hampshire, but northern New Hampshire starts experiencing 20 to 30 of these days in the future, end of the century, as opposed to the few that they experience today. We're also expect to see significant decreases in the number of snow-covered days across New Hampshire and warming winters, and that's going to have a real impact on our winter recreational opportunities. Ski areas can adapt by blowing more snow as long as it's cold enough, but by the end of the century, under the high-emission scenarios, they can't do that much anymore. But cross-country ski areas and ice fishermen and snowmobilers really aren't going to have much of an adaptive strategy here, and I fear we're going to lose that part of our culture under the high-emission scenario. The low-emission scenario, conversely, has a lot of change that we likely can adapt to and maintain some semblance of sort of the seasons that we've come to love across much of New Hampshire.
So the low emission scenario is we turn more to non-fossil fuel sources of energy. Carbon dioxide emissions go down and things change, but not nearly as dramatically.
Absolutely. There is an important point I should add there is that there is an amount of change that's baked into the system. So whether or
already.
Not... Already. So, and that's because when I drove over here today from the seacoast, I emitted carbon dioxide that's going to be in the atmosphere for well over 100 years. And the climate system itself has considerable inertia. It takes a long time to change. There's a lot of heat that's stored in the ocean, for example. So when we look out to 2050, there's really very little difference in our projections of climate change between the high emissions and low emissions scenario. It's going to be a warmer, wetter New Hampshire. We're going to have to deal with that. And that's really a planning horizon that planners deal with, sort of 10 to 20, maybe 30 years. And then the real difference is out at the end of the century, whether we follow the high emissions or the low emissions scenario. And that's not just New Hampshire. That's important to note. That's global emissions that are going to be driving our climate here in New Hampshire. So it's the global community that really needs to figure out how to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions if we want to be on the low emissions scenario.
Okay, Michael, I have a question for you too. But while we're talking about projections, especially as far out as the end of the century, here's an email that came in from Rob. He says, aren't global warming predictions based solely on computer models that are in turn based on assumed data? Al Gore predicted as recently as 2009 that, quote, the North Pole would be ice-free by 2013. It makes these predictions of doom very hard to take seriously when they are made regularly, but never seem to come true. When one doesn't come true, it's replaced by another dire prediction, and on it goes. So some skepticism from Rob, and thank you, Rob, for the email, not just about how much the climate may be changing, but also just, you know, computer models can have flaws.
Absolutely. There's a common axiom is that all models are wrong. Some models are useful. In fact, global climate models are incredibly useful tools. And if you look to the scientific literature and you look back even to the early models, the projections that they made for climate change were actually dead on. The place where they have been lacking has really been none of those models predicted the rapid decline in Arctic sea ice that we've seen. And so, in fact, in many cases, the models are underestimating the rapid change in the system. And that's because the Earth has a whole suite of very complex, what we call feedback loops. We could call them, in more common language, vicious cycles. So once you reduce a little bit of snow, the ground warms up and you reduce a lot more snow. And that's what is happening with Arctic sea ice. But they're very useful tools. And when you look to the scientific literature, those models have done a good job at forecasting the change that we've already seen.
And again, from these forecasts down on the ground to the community level, you know, we've seen a lot of extreme weather events in recent years, as both of you have said. And Michael Simpson, you've talked about some of the community vulnerabilities, roads, bridges. bridges, electric grids, and so forth. New Hampshire really lucked out when Hurricane Irene hit a couple years back. But just over the border from where you are in Keene, in Vermont, they were not so lucky. What did we learn about climate change preparedness from Vermont's experience with Irene?
Obviously, the biggest impact was to water conveyance infrastructure, that is basically the streams where they met built infrastructure, which was the roads. And what we learned is that something that's been going on besides climate change, and I got to be very honest, that we've been building out our landscape and putting more impervious surface on it. So the two came together.
Impervious surface means
cement or asphalt or rooftops.
Doesn't suck up water, just it rushes off.
And so Irene was an extreme event. But it coupled with more impervious surface so that the vulnerable points were where roads met historic culverts, bridges, et cetera. And as a result, we basically cut off populations. We cut off towns for quite a long time. We learned a lot about electricity, providing electricity, learned a lot about communication from that storm and how to better keep communication going. There was a lot of learning around emergency response, and it has improved dramatically since that event.
Emergency response meaning just rescuing people in trouble or more than that?
More than that, building in the resilience so that when it occurs again, there's a better response, decentralizing the safety net that's out there, and as opposed to having one fire station, having it decentralized so that it gets to, if one gets cut off, others are there for support. So it's actually has moved the agenda much further in that aspect of adaptation.
Well, in Sandy, we saw that in the New York area, and I'm wondering what other lessons we can pull from that. Now, New Hampshire doesn't have as much coast, but still.
Well, the one thing that is probably the most obvious change is we are seeing a sea level rise, and that is measurable. And we know that, you know, during storm events, where you have storm surges on top of a full moon and high tide, we're seeing what the extent of flooding could be. A recent release by the White House on Climate Data Initiative basically wants to create data so planners can make decisions, and their first focus is on sea level rise with this data initiative, because it is unlike the inland, the line of where the tide goes can be drawn pretty easily. When you talk about inland events and inland vulnerabilities, it's so decentralized and the landscape's so variable.
Inland meaning lakes and rivers and so forth.
And valleys.
And who knows how they're going to react. We saw that right in your area of the state with the flood in Alsted six years ago.
Yeah, the Alsted flood in 2005 basically, and a number of events since then have shown the communities what they need to do. And you're actually starting to see Keene and the surrounding communities starting to change their infrastructure in order to adapt to that. The thing about changing infrastructure is you don't need to change it until you do, but realize once you've done it, it's there for the life of the infrastructure. And so it's very important if you're going to change a wastewater treatment facility, you're going to change a culvert, realize that's a 30 to 60 year decision. So you have to bring in possibilities of a variable climate into that decision.
The possibility of a 100-year storm, which seems to be happening every 5 or 6 years or so. All right, let's go to our listeners. Gentlemen, again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And Marjorie is calling from Hanover. Hi, Marjorie. Go ahead. You're on the exchange.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to comment. Your speaker mentioned a couple things, and one is decreasing our admissions. I'd like to mention there's a lot of efforts right now regarding solarizing your home, and there's a group that's working actually across the Vermont and New Hampshire border called Solarize the Upper Valley. And solar prices right now are at historic lows, and they work with homeowners to get even better prices because they get groups of people and they get a volume discount. And that's an excellent effort and an excellent way. It's a good time right now to, purchase and decrease your emissions. And then the other thing regarding the floods, I don't think anyone's mentioned that we really need to protect our wetlands to deflect and decrease the effect of those bad storms. And the New Hampshire DES is going around the state right now having a lot of listening meetings to take input on just, how and why, and we should do that. And I know I haven't been particularly pleased with how some of the wetlands in my town have been protected, and I'd like to see better protection of them.
Okay, Margie, thanks a lot for the call. And financial incentives, Michael, to change to non-fossil fuel sources of energy.
Well, first, can I respond to the comment? I was originally trained as a wetland scientist. So one of the things that we're finding is, you know, just a hardware fix is not enough. If a town enlarges all its culverts, all it's doing is pushing the flood down to the next town. And on a larger scale of adaptation, we need to think about what do we preserve on the landscape that's going to mitigate how extreme the impact is. And so the caller's point of preserving wetlands is a very, very good point.
So we're helping ourselves out when we do
this. It is an adaptation strategy that needs to be looked at seriously, is what on the landscape do we preserve in order to mitigate how extreme the impacts are going to be at the vulnerable points.
Yeah, do you want to jump in, Cameron?
I'd love to jump in on the solar aspect here. In the Climate Action Plan, we called for improving the energy efficiency of our homes by 60%, every home across New Hampshire, and that really requires significant investment. But Marjorie's point is a good one, is that we need to be considering solar and geothermal and biomass energy if we really want to lay the foundation for our energy security in the future. And the big challenge here, frankly, is going to be the investment. Where's the money going to come from? There's some small government subsidies that can help, but we really need to figure out how to get private money into the game. And there's some organizations across New Hampshire that are doing this. Community Loan Fund helps businesses actually invest in their energy efficiency so they can be more effective businesses in the future. The recently formed New Hampshire Clean Tech Council is really trying to figure out how we invest in energy efficiency and renewables in this state. So we really need to figure out how we get the private money to help homeowners and businesses make that transition. And frankly, we don't mind fossil fuels in New Hampshire and New England, so they do very little use for our economy. If we're going to improve our energy security and actually really improve the opportunities for employment, we really need to invest in energy efficiency and renewables.
Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Marjorie, thanks a lot for that call. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You know, Cameron Wake, you talked earlier about that less good scenario, the pessimistic scenario where New Hampshire gets a lot warmer and a lot wetter, and the less bad scenario, the more optimistic scenario where, yes, it changes, but not quite so much. But you said that's going to depend on us using a lot less fossil fuels. How optimistic are you, Cameron, about getting to this future, given the opposition we've seen to, you know, all sorts of alternative energy, from wind to hydro to nuclear to whatever?
I think it's a tremendous challenge, and I don't see us having as made much progress as I would have liked our region or our nation to have made. But I will say, in the state of New Hampshire, we are absolutely on the right path, and we are now decoupling economic growth from greenhouse gas emissions. So while our gross state product continues to go up, our greenhouse gas emissions have been dropping since 2004.
Wow. Now, how did we do that?
There was a whole range of reasons that happened. One is the price of oil and gasoline went up. There was a range of different energy efficiency measures that were made affordable. It's a complex reaction to a whole suite of market forces. There's only not one particular thing, but there's no doubt that the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative has had a significant effect. And that's really one where we help utilities generate energy with more low-carbon fuels. The big challenge, though, is that we have to do this globally. So we are figuring out how to do that in the United States and Europe, but we now need to help China and India and Indonesia as those economies grow. And we need to ensure that they can grow in a way that was different from how we grew, which was relying on fossil fuel energy.
Yeah, so and don't do it the way we did it.
If they follow that pathway, really, there is no doubt we will be on the high emission scenario.
Let's take another call if we could. George is in Effingham. Hi, George. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, I've just got a kind of a comment. I've noticed that, at least in my community, a lot of people who are advocating for adaptation are then the same people who are opposed to it once it's specifically applied. So, for example, people are in favor of wind power, but then once there's an actual proposal, they're opposed to the specific one in their backyard or whatever. And I see that as a big challenge in that the same proponents for renewable energies turn out to be the people that actually oppose it, and I see that as a major hindrance for adapting.
Yeah, George, it's a great question. And this is what I was trying to get at with you, Cameron, and Michael, I want to hear from you, too. You know, it's one thing to say I love a green energy future. It's another thing to say, ooh, I don't want that nuclear power plant down the road. Or the wind turbine, or the hydro tower.
So it's a big challenge to transform an energy system. We've been through a couple of these in sort of Western civilization, and it takes a long time, sort of on the average of 40 to 60 years. So we're beginning to see that discussion going on now. And I think it's important for communities to pipe up if, in fact, they don't want that big wind turbine in their backyard. But I also think we have to be a little bit more strategic about how we approach this issue. And that's now happening across the state of New Hampshire, especially with wind. Where are we going to site wind? Where's the best place for that in the future? I'd also say that there's lots that individuals can do, and we should not be looking to state government to solve this problem. So individuals can make their homes much more energy efficient. They can be generating much of the energy they need. We can really look at the way our transportation system works and really invest in those local communities across New Hampshire that we love. So everybody in New Hampshire can actually walk to get a gallon of milk, and we have walking communities. So there's lots that communities can do. It's not just big energy projects.
So that's some of the low-hanging fruit, right, Michael?
It is, and I just want to make the point that, you know, a decentralized system, especially in a variable climate, is an important way in which to adapt. And decentralized energy systems will actually, you know, support our economy and actually allow our economy to grow because the jobs will be here. You know, if you have a centralized system where the, you know, where energy sources are coming from far afield and where the capital is really being put, it's outside the state. But if we go to a decentralized approach, we actually will have more security here, more resilience to adapt and respond. And actually, we will actually be hiring people to do this work. We need to install this. We need to, you know, look at these. Now, not in my backyard. It's always been a challenge for us as environmentalists and scientists. It's not easy to manage change, but, you know, change has to be managed and we have to move forward.
All right. Well, guys, it's been really good to talk to you. Interesting stuff. Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much,
okay,
Laura.
Thank you.
Cameron Wake, climatology professor at the UNH Institute for the Study of Earth, Oceans, and Space, and Michael Simpson, climate adaptation scientist at Antioch University, New England. Coming up, as floods become more of a threat, more people may need flood insurance, but there's a lot of controversy surrounding the federal flood insurance program. We'll find out more in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next I and Reem show, how the Civil Rights Act changed America, their new efforts to bring extinct species back to life, all coming up on the Diane Reem Show.
The Diane Reem Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. New Hampshire weather, sunshine today, high temperatures mid-50s to lower 60s, partly cloudy in the evening, then mostly cloudy, a chance of rain showers after midnight, lows tonight mid-30s to lower 40s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Geriatric Psychiatry Services at Frisbee Memorial Hospital in Rochester, specializing in mental and behavioral health for people 65 and older in outpatient or inpatient settings, frisbeehospital.com. And from Mill Falls at the Lake, Four Inns offering Winnipesaukee Lakefront Lodging, 7 restaurants, 12 marketplace shops, the Cascade Spa, and Ekel Lake Activity Center, millfalls.com.